Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Genocide Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host today, Jeff Bachman. Thank you all for listening. Today, we will be talking to Eva von Ruckel about her new book, Phenomenal Justice, Violence and Morality in Argentina, published in January of this year by Rutgers University Press for its Genocide, Political Violence, and Human Rights series. Eva von Ruckel, welcome to the show. Eva, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself. Where you were born, where you went to school, and did you have a mentor?
Hi, Jeff. First of all, thank you very much for inviting me. Where I was born, I come from the Netherlands, and I was born in the south in a middle-sized town where I went to high school. And when I was 15, I did an exchange year to Venezuela. And I can say that became kind of a life-changing experience. 20 years later, I can say that, I think. And after that exchange year, I started off living in between the Netherlands and Venezuela, where I also started studying at the university when I graduated high school in the Netherlands first. And while studying the strikes against the Chavez government in the early 2000s were kind of like impeding me to continue. But then I decided to return to the Netherlands and take up language and cultural studies in Utrecht University, but did all my internships and research in Venezuela. And this is how I kind of got more and more involved into Latin American studies, which I also decided to do for a master's. And there I came like really involved in anthropology and violence because of the Department of Cultural Anthropology at Utrecht University is very much, back then was very much focused on Latin America and violence. And a mentor, I didn't really have a mentor. I think all staff at the anthropology department was really, really inspiring people. I think for the first time I was not a student number, and the people in Latin America were not just faraway communities but like real people. And well, one of them was Antonius Robben. I think well, in genocide studies he's a quite well-known anthropologist, and he also became my PhD supervisor later on. And I remember that's 15 years ago, taking one of his courses, and that was Culture, Violence, Trauma, and Reconciliation. And it was really like, well, entering a new world. It was really fascinating.
That's really interesting. Can you, I'm curious about this exchange program, just briefly. Is that typical for students in the Netherlands? Because it's not something I'm, you know, sort of familiar with here going to high school in the United States.
No, it wasn't really familiar. I did know one girl who, on the same age, she went to Japan, and then I got acquainted with the program, and my parents too. So we also had some exchange students in our house when I was younger. And one of them, just a year before I went to Venezuela, was a girl from Venezuela. And that was like, always wanted to go to Latin America. And then I was like, kind of impulsively, I said, oh, I go to Venezuela then. And well, then it happened. And back then, it wasn't such I remember saying it to one of my peers in class, and she said, Venezuela, Venezuela, is that somewhere in Africa? And it wasn't really on. It wasn't really a well-known country, and also back then it was quite different from how it is today, of course.
So that already addresses some of my follow-up question around Latin America and your interest in anthropology. So maybe you could tell us what led you to do research on Argentina, from Venezuela to Argentina.
Yeah. Well, as I said, during my bachelor's and my master's, I did a lot of research on the political conflict in Venezuela and on issues on poverty and criminal violence, which was also partially, induced by what was happening at the department, of course. And when I graduated, I really liked it at the university, but I have this kind of a love-hate relationship with academia. So I thought, no, I need to get out of the university. I need to work. I need to do other stuff. And I started with a documentary project also in Venezuela, and I started working on an NGO in the Netherlands. But then after a year or so, I was like, no, I want to go back and do more field work and write and read more. And I was very lucky. But at that moment, when I was kind of like thinking about it and contemplating on returning to the university, that they opened a vacancy, a PhD project for 4 years at my previous department under the guidance of Tonius Robin on the trials for crimes against humanity in Argentina. It was a kind of like, wow, yeah, this is what I really want. And I hadn't really been to I only had been to Argentina for like 2 weeks. In between my master's fieldwork, some of my peers were doing fieldwork in Buenos Aires, and I visited them, but that was all. So it was, on the one hand, a kind of a continuation of my topic of interest, and still in the Latin American country, but yeah, Argentina, Venezuela, it's a different world, of course. So it was really starting off anew. It was a great, great experience. Yeah,
great. You mentioned now the crimes against humanity in Argentina. For our audience, before we get into the specifics of your book, could you tell them a little bit about this period between 1976 and 1983 in Argentina?
Yes, I can. Yeah. I think like in whole Latin American countries, the 70s were quite turbulent times. We were in the midst of the Cold War. And in Latin America, there were many left-wing guerrilla groups trying to take over long-seated conservative and sometimes also very authoritarian regimes. Argentina was not really an exception in that sense. But to like zoom in a little bit more, in the mid-70s, in 1976, and then now late president Isabel Perón, who was the wife of the previous president, Juan Perón, she had assumed power after he deceased, and the situation became very, very unstable. And the amount of assaults and kidnappings of elites, and then as a response, paramilitary groups grouped under the AAA were also already killing and disappearing left-wing opponents. It was kind of this state of emergency that within the government and elite groups in society, they really urged for an interference of the military. And then on March 24, 1976, the notorious military junta came to power. And then the killings and the disappearings that were already happening by these paramilitary groups became more institutionalized within the armed forces. And the junta started to systematically kidnap, torture, kill, and disappear thousands of Argentinians. And that were, on the one hand, armed guerrilla members, but also human rights lawyers, teachers at the university, union members, anyone, as I also write, could be chupado, sucked up by the regime. And I think when we think of Argentina and that period, there are like two particular, despite the enormous amount of disappearances, it's also the practice of the death flights, vuelos de la muerte, that they pulled people drugged but still alive out of the airplanes above the South Atlantic, and also the appropriation of children that were born in illegal detention centers, because the pregnant women were also being kidnapped and tortured, and after giving birth, these children were appropriated from a military perspective. They would say they were adopted. And until today, many of them still have a different identity. So these two crimes are particularly notorious in the context of Argentina. But again, and I think I also, I hope I do that in the book, this is a very contested history. Some people say it was from the very beginning very systematic. Other voices say, no, it was complete chaos. It was out of control. And there were some cells just within the armed forces doing whatever they wanted. And I think also talking with different groups from victims and that kind of like comprises relatives and survivors and people loyal to them and the perpetrators, yeah, it reveals very different perspectives. And that also made it very difficult to write one fixed history of the violence. So I decided not to do so either in the book. Instead of focusing on a history of violence, I opted for looking at time and different experiences and understandings of time. Kind of like get away from, okay, this is what happened, because I understood while being there, it's not clear what happened. It's so tied to moral judgments and particular experiences tied to, well, ideologies that, yeah, you cannot really untie that from, well, that's my perspective. Perhaps an historian would say otherwise. Yeah.
That also connects to the questions of what is justice under these circumstances and the crimes that were committed and the different experiences of different people. What is phenomenal justice, and how, if at all, like, how is it different than our typical understandings of what transitional justice is?
Yeah, I struggled very much with transitional justice from the start. First of all, I'm not a legal scholar, and I suddenly was like exposed to this literature. Quite difficult. I remember going to court for the first time. I live in the Netherlands, so I thought, if I'm going to study the trials for crimes against humanity, I've in my life I'd ever been to a courthouse. So I went for an afternoon to the International Criminal Court in The Hague just to see what it is about. And I was like, oh, what am I going to do as an anthropologist? It's going to be hard. And when I went to Argentina, I think when I started reading all these files, I was like, oh, it's going to be, no, this is not the way I should go, I think. I need to come up with something different. But now coming to phenomenal justice, first of all, it's not a new concept. Like something what we now see in transitional justice, the whole notion of post-transitional justice to make kind of like sense of all these practices of truth and justice and memory so long after the violence has ceased. This is not what phenomenal justice is. It's rather an approach, a way of looking at these practices that blend existential anthropology, also called phenomenological anthropology, and this is where the phenomenal part of the title comes from. And that really focuses on the lived experience of the phenomenon under study. And I combine this with a field in anthropology called the anthropology of emotion. And how I see it, both share, even within anthropology, a very deep concern for person-centered narratives and the very intersubjective dimension of life and research. And it employs, we call it kind of a radical reflexive stance, which means that also the experiences of the ethnographer are very important to understand what you're trying to study. And I think this combination of, well, this really person-centered approach, this focus on the intersubjective dimension of the field and your own, part in it and reflect upon that. I think that really varies from transitional justice, which I think still tries to capture all these practices in, well, kind of like comprehensive models and categories and focus less on the messiness, I think, of the people that are really part and partial of these practices. And then I also include the ethnographer. And it's also a little bit of a perhaps an anthropological critique against new concepts, perhaps, and thinking that we can just think that, oh, let's introduce a new concept and then the world again is neat and comprehensible. I think our concepts are always too shallow and too temporary to really make sense of what's going on out there. Yeah.
So. You know, with the you sort of allude to this already, but why are feelings and emotion important, and how might one? I don't know if you have received any critique of, you know, emphasizing feeling and emotion, but why might one criticize or critique you know, such an emphasis.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. I also write a little bit about it because I think it's good to take into account when you take a feelings perspective. But first, why I ended up focusing on the feelings. And it was really what happened in my first encounter with a sentence at one of the courthouses, the federal courts in Argentina. I went in 2009 for a first field trip, 2 months, and I was lucky. That sounds a bit strange, but and these 8 weeks, there was also already a sentence that I could participate in. And it was such an emotionally dense and intriguing event that it really had to become my point of departure. I was like, this is what I want to study. And I write about that also in the prologue of the book. And particularly the difference in emotional repertoires between, on the one hand, the perpetrators and their relatives and people loyal to them, and on the other side, the victims and their relatives. It was so, in my opinion, striking that I really wanted to focus upon that. And this focus on feelings also pushed me in the direction of existential anthropology, to be able to kind of like analyze it as a lived experience without turning all these emotions into kind of a neat model, like the military, they do this and that, how they feel, and the victims do this and that. So it was kind of like this, on the one hand, the field pushing me towards feelings, and to be able to be faithful to that messiness of the feelings, I turned to existential anthropology. One of the critiques, which is focusing on these kind of more experiences and not so much on underlying structures, perhaps, can avoid a kind of they call it navel gazing, or you're kind of missing out on very important, power inequalities, the structural inequalities of impunity, for example. But I think by listening to these critiques during paper presentations and in my conversations with my supervisor, but also with people in the field, I think I managed to kind of like incorporate, on the one hand, these feelings in all their messiness, together with, mentioning and attention to these structural inequalities that are part of how these trials are taking shape. So, and I think both are co-constitutive to effective life. So yes, there is critique, but on the other hand, I think we always have to take one focus. Unfortunately, we cannot. Yeah, I would love to, but really have to like focus on something. And to me, it was really the field that pushed me towards this focus on the emotional dimension. Yeah,
I think that connects to also the significance of trauma and memory. I'm curious, what are the significances that you found of trauma and memory in Argentina, both in connection with dealing with the crimes committed and the justice proceedings that you witnessed?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in the case of Argentina, trauma and memory, they're kind of essential local notions to understand what justice is, particularly in regard to the military dictatorship, but more general to ongoing injustices and impunity. And I have to be careful now, Brad, without undoing the legal and political and symbolic significance of this fight against impunity after these horrible crimes. I also came to understand that the trials were kind of a continuation of a shared therapy that already lasts for more than 40 years, and that makes people in Argentina moral beings, I would say. So I think if you kind of overlook how they define and understand the power of trauma and how they conceptualize memory, I think you're kind of missing out on something very important, what's going on in the trial. So it was really also about giving voice to these traumas and these ever-changing memories, which is what I try to explain, is an ongoing, never-ending process. And the courthouse is another field, a very important one because of its, its legal presence, but we should not mistake it for something that is separated from these yet ongoing struggles in other social fields in Argentina. So, I think if you, and I'm not really sure, but Argentina has been taken as kind of an example often in literature on transitional justice, call it a justice cascade or trigger for all these truth and justice practices. And you see also this focus on trauma and memory elsewhere. But I'm not sure if the meanings and understandings of these of trauma and memory in other contexts are similar to the context of Argentina. I think there is a very particular local twist to it, which is very important to take into account. And I write also about this in terms on the presence of psychoanalysis. Particularly in the urban areas in Argentina, psychoanalysis is very important. Yeah. Meaning-making framework, how people understand what suffering is, but also how the self is made up. And this focus on trauma and memory within the truth and justice practices have direct links to this psychoanalytical understanding of self. And I think anthropology is very well equipped to embrace also and look upon these, perhaps at first sight, not so important or not so significant dealings for legal proceedings, which I do think are very important to take into account. And also it, how can I not extend for hours, but these understandings of self and trauma even mold the way legal justice is being performed in the courthouses, because I can remember talking to judges which have also been exposed to the psychoanalytical understandings of what it means to live with trauma, that one of them I remember said, no, the very practice of catharsis, he even used that word, is essential to the process of justice. And you could see that also in the makeup of the trials. Sometimes it were just hours and hours victims talking about what had happened to them or to people who disappeared, or relatives that disappeared. Sometimes I remember sitting at court like really doubting the judicial relevance of all this. And I remember even talking to, I think it was a lawyer from the United States, and he was also interested in the trials, and I once like whispered, "What is this about? Why is this relevant?" He says, "No, this has no legal value." So yeah, something else was going on there, and well, I think it's important to include that in our analysis. Yeah,
I mean, in a way that the testimonies sort of bridge that divide between sharing feeling and emotion and participating in the more procedural transitional justice mechanisms. So kind of started to address the role of testimony in the proceedings and how some of the people who spoke were able to speak extensively about their experience. You described a number of these testimonies in your book. Is there any one that stood out to you?
Yeah. Oh, there were so many that kind of like grabbed me and kept me like thinking about it for days, sometimes even often years. And I think one was really remarkable, I remember, was a woman who had been in one of the largest detention centers in Buenos Aires, the ESMA, for quite a long period, like almost 2 years. And she talked for more than 4 hours straight. There was no interruption and there was no recess. She just talked and talked and talked. And it was kind of like these vivid descriptions about what was going on. And what really struck me was like the kind of like horrific mundaneness of how she spoke about it and how her everyday life was within this illegal detention center. And another, there were like two testimonies, and I write about that too. There were two girls, both of them had disappeared parents, and they testified about the experience of not being around their parents, first not knowing where they were because they were being kidnapped, and later on, well, assumingly being killed, but still not knowing and not being able to properly mourn about that loss. And it was, they were both in their late 20s, early 30s, I guess, and they had the same experience, and they were right after one another. They were part of the same trial, and these testimonies were so different. Really, I remember sitting there at court, like, oh, how am I going to, like, it's impossible to generalize this. I really should put focus on the on the idiosyncrasies of these testimonies and the experiences of people. I cannot just say, okay, for children it means this and that, and for the relative this and that. It would not make sense. So these were kind of like moments that really pushed me again towards this more focus on person-centered approach and not trying to generalize based on one or two experiences. It's also awkward because when the perpetrator spoke, it was not called testimony. These were declarations. it's interesting. I remember having a conversation about this with colleagues in Utrecht studying the Holocaust, and they were talking about perpetrators' testimony. He said, no, these are not testimonies. These are declarations. Something different. And that's also interesting how you see how these terms also become kind of like co-opted by, particularly in Argentina, by victims. This is their domain. The testimony is theirs. And the declarations of the perpetrators, they were very detached. Well, kind of like war stories about how they had to move their troops. And I remember it didn't really touch me in the same way as the testimony, but it intrigued me and it really gave me the impetus to look into that part of the transitional the trial as well. So what is it that these men are trying to uphold here, or is this really how they envision or understand the world? Is it only strategy, or what's going on there? So I think there was again a striking difference in how they performed between these four walls.
I want to talk a little bit more about your interactions with Argentinians. But before we get to that, sticking with the court, after describing a day in court and a partial exodus of viewers of the proceedings from the public gallery, you wrote, quote, "That day I learned that presence and absence in the public gallery were embodied acts of solidarity and dissent among the victims. Attending court sessions on the one hand involved reciprocal exchanges between victims and on the other hand embodied expressions of dissent against the military officers. In a way, this excerpt encouraged me to think about the various tensions present in informal and formal justice proceedings. Can you tell us what you observed about these tensions, from that between victims and survivors and the military officers, and the military officers and the victims and survivors, and both groups as the act and the actual proceedings?"
Well, I think first it's the formal and informal always fused within the trial's proceedings. Perhaps on paper, you only had the formal part that was being reflected. And I think also many anthropologists before me have always said it's perhaps a bit too reductionist to base an experience of justice only on what's on paper. And I think particularly by being there at court, you can really see how these informal and formal justice experience fuse. And what, for example, what's causing mostly tensions, I think, is also the different expectations and outcomes of formal and informal justice present in the trial. Just imagine that for 40 years you have waited for this moment to sit in court and to be able to tell your story of survival or the testimony of having a disappeared relative. And you know that the person who has been actually involved in that crime will be present in the courtroom that day. That's a very important moment, also a very anxious moment. Many of the victims have also been, preparing themselves weeks, sometimes months, sometimes. And then when the moment is there, you're sitting in the courtroom and the person is falling asleep, for example. It doesn't really matter for the outcome, perhaps for the official outcome of the court proceedings, but for that particular person, seeing that person falling asleep while you're telling the most important story of your life, it's very offensive. And then what? You should not erase that part of the justice experience, although on paper it doesn't really matter. And on the other side, if you flip it, as I already said, testimonies sometimes were very long, something 4 or 5 hours. It was really giving victims, so that means relatives and survivors, the opportunity to talk and to verbalize what has happened to them and which is still so present in their lives. And as I said, sometimes the legal value of these testimonies were not that clear. So it was also sometimes having 20, 30 people of the courthouse present and just, listening to these stories, which was not really perhaps that important for getting to a verdict. But on the other side, if I talked with the military and their relatives about that, it was a thorn in the eye for them to have them listen hours and hours about these experiences. So then you see that the informal, it is allowed within the formal setting. And it's also kind of changing what formal justice is. But it also causes different expectations and outcomes, and that can clash. And I think we should, pay attention to these tensions, I guess, because, I think only a verdict is not the whole part of what it means for people to get justice done for crimes against humanity. So, that's also a reason why I decided not to focus or kind of divide the formal and the informal. At the beginning, I kind of played with the idea, as many people do, to kind of see it as a ritual and see it as a theater play, as a performance. And then I thought, well, of course, there are very much ritualized behaviors in the courtroom, but also when the moment was off, it was very much infused with the performance. So I decided, no, I'm not going to juxtapose the formal and the informal. I'm just going to see it as a total fact, let's say, as Irvin Goffman also says. Yeah.
And this gets at, the impact on the justice proceedings on the individual and group experiences of the of those who are survivors or had family members that were disappeared. You already alluded to this a little bit, but, rarely do survivors of crimes against humanity have the undivided attention, assuming they stay awake, of the individuals and the institutions that committed the crimes against them and their families. Were you given any sense that the overflowing feelings and emotions that were expressed to you and during the trials grew out of this opportunity to finally, have the quote unquote, they're finally have the day in court?
Yes, I do think that these few square meters where they could finally tell their experiences, I think it is a heightened emotional experience. I think, which is also so contradictory because the law, what it tries to do is contain that emotion, or at least that's what we think, right? But I also felt in that sense, this whole idea that law kind of tries to like keep emotions out of the courtroom, I felt it was very different in Argentina in that sense. And I also remember when a colleague, Alexander Hinton, also an anthropologist, doing a lot of research on genocide studies within Cambodia, and he was also in Buenos Aires attending a court session, and he was so, surprised by how, on the one hand, informal it was, but also how highly emotional the events were. So I think this is also where I think formal, informal, you kind of like, you have to look it into context. And I think, and that's also what I try to do in my book, to try to contextualize these emotions. In many literature on transitional justice, we talk so much about revenge or hatred or suffering, but I do think how people experience these feelings is so context dependent, and also how people give meaning to these feelings. We have to look into that also to better grapple with what these truth and justice practices are and what they're aiming at. So it was important to tell these testimonies in front of the state who committed these crimes, of course, and particular individuals who were part of the day of the torture, the day of the disappearance, the days of the killings. But at the same time, there were these unexpected or unintended consequences that the person could fall asleep or was kind of like with gazes and looks trying to defy you, or maybe make mistakes in your testimony, or maybe that would be would make it unreliable. So on the one end, yes, there was a tension, but I'm not really sure if it was undivided. And it was also under quite some pressure. For some, it was very difficult to be in the same room with people who tortured you, for example. So yeah, it was both, I guess. It was a very important experience, but at the same time, also it could also result in something unexpected, and in some cases, re-traumatic, perhaps. Not saying that they didn't want to have that experience, but still, not an easy one.
During your field research in Argentina, can you talk a bit about who you spoke to, how they were chosen for your research, why you spoke to them, or what you hope to learn from them, and also maybe add whether you expected such strong feelings and emotions to be present?
Yeah, well, I think that the only thing that was really important from the very beginning was I want to, what they say in Argentina, hear both bells, ambas campanas, so implying that I wanted really to hear the stories of the victims, but also those of the perpetrators. But I also interviewed and talked to many judges and human rights lawyers and defense lawyers, other people working at the courts, people from security, a lot of therapists, psychologists were also involved in the trials proceedings. And I talked a lot with the children of the perpetrators and their wives and relatives of the disappeared. So it was kind of a very heterogeneous group. I think in total there were like 200 persons that were kind of directly or indirectly involved to the trials and the violence. And I used the snowball method, friends and then friends and then friends, which was quite an easy method to get in touch. People were quite willing to talk. Also, some of the indicted officers, I got access to a military prison. And from there, I had like 20, 30 indicted officers. Some of them were already convicted. I could also talk various times to ex-General Videla. He was also in that prison. And he was not that willing to talk with me. But yeah, we had some interesting conversations that I write about in the book as well. And what did I want to know? I wanted to know, first of all, how they define justice, how they give meaning to it, how they understood the past and what these trials were and why they were important. And I, from the first day, I understood, okay, this is a very ideological struggle still, and it will be very difficult to have one clear idea what this past is and how these trials will be judged now and in the future. And these emotions, as I already said at the beginning, I think it was not really in my mind when I went for the first time. But when I was during the first verdict, it was so in the face, and I was just sitting there in the public gallery and seeing all these different emotions of people, and also on the one hand, a very reserved group of officers that were kind of like swallowing their life sentences, and on the other hand, a very emotionally touched group of victims who were finally getting a sense of justice, but that was also a partial justice because some of the perpetrators were being acquitted. So it was a very emotionally dense moment, and that was really, okay, this is what I want to focus upon. But I do remember having some conversations with judges, and I was trying to figure out what their emotional experience was of the trials. And sometimes I said, maybe I'm looking for something which is not there. I don't know. But that's also perhaps the bias of each researcher. So I also tried to back off and just go with the flow. I think that's what anthropologists also do. Sometimes we have a perfect interview, and then we just, after 5 minutes, you throw it in the pin. You throw it away and just keep talking what people want to talk about. And that's what I think is also, helps you to not frame too much the research into a direction that you think the topic is about, but you really allow the people that you try to understand give voice there. So it was a big struggle to get all these voices into a kind of, a coherent story and to write a book about it. But I managed. I'm happy with the result.
I think so, too.
Yeah.
Eva, in speaking with both survivors and perpetrators, did you learn anything maybe unexpected, such as a sense of understanding about what happened from survivors or remorse from perpetrators?
No. none of them. No, there was not so much. Well, there was one thing which I think is interesting to what I did notice was one, I was able to be in close contact with one of he was a guerrilla member of one of the biggest armed guerrilla groups. And he was, in a sense, kind of understanding towards the military on trial. He really thought it was not very just that only them, they were being prosecuted. He once said, I have blood on my hands too. But because I was not part of the state, I cannot be prosecuted anymore. But these men, did horrible crimes, but not all of them, should be punished for it. Something like that, but that was quite remarkable. And in a sense, he was also well aware that it was not something to. It was not easy to voice this in public. There was little understanding. I think from the part of the victims towards the perpetrators, which is of course logical if you see what the violence has done to the lives of these people and also their children. It's massive, of course. And in terms of remorse, no. And I write a lot about remorse because if you read transitional justice and genocide, there is this enormous urge from victims and societies as large, at least in the literature, that we want them to be remorseful. Kind of like that's something that we really need to be able to move forward. And you don't see it that much remorse, particularly in Argentina. It's not so much there. And I try to, I write in a chapter what I call disgrace. And it's what I say, what I think is very important to understand how the military are experiencing the past and also the present trials as a form of disgrace, as a form of shame. They really like untie the idea of accountability and wrongdoing. So it's more kind of a wrong being. They in private conversations they did admit that terrible crimes were committed and they really did not comply with their imagination very high standards of being a military. And but it was not that they felt guilty for it or accountable for it because they have this idea of, and then comes the whole idea, order is an order, befehl is befehl, and in Holocaust literature, which outrages so many people, which of course is also very imaginable. But I kind of like try to show also that it's such a dead end, in a sense, to wish for remorse, because it's very often kind of emotionally not possible for the perpetrators who are kind of part of this enormous network of state executed violence. It was such, they kind of like undo accountability from they put it on the hierarchy, the leaders who ordered wrongly. And I also kind of like pushed it, but if you receive an immoral order, then what? But they say, no, at the moment it wasn't an immoral order. It turned to be immoral afterwards. But it's a kind of a very, they feel very shameful in a sense, but not accountable. So expressing remorse, and I write about it also, would be an act of betrayal. And I write in one of the beginnings of a section that the former dictator, General Videla, the closing words of one of the trials in Cordoba, is kind of congratulating all his inferiors for being such a good soldiers and keeping up morale really trying to show what the violence was and why they did what they did. And then a kind of like, but he says, except one sergeant. And that was the one who, one of the very few, it's not the only one, it did happen more. But he expressed remorse and he really asked for forgiveness. And then he did that, which is so much urged for by victims and society at large, but he was being punished from his own people right away. So it also really doesn't help, I guess, to create space for remorse within the perpetrators. So, and then understanding from the perpetrators towards the victims, I think the whole idea of the pain of the mother who has a disappeared child or a disappeared grandchild was all very understanding. They understood it was terrible, but they always try to explain and justify that in every war, people disappear and females are suffering, kind of this kind of masculine, conservative understanding of the suffering woman, perhaps. But there was also less understanding because of the political play of the trials, and they say they're kind of like continue opening the wounds and they're making it worse by again and again and again mentioning it, and they're creating more hatred and less harmony in society. So kind of like it cut both ways, the thing on understanding. On the one hand, the eternal suffering mother was something that they shared, and they understood that this was kind of like it needed a certain form of justice, but how it was being done was really, well, unforgiving in their perspective from the military.
And that connects in some ways to something you mentioned earlier about reliving the trauma through these formal proceedings. And so I wonder, were there any ethical concerns in conducting your research? Were there safety, security concerns for you personally and for the individuals you spoke to? And how did you go about alleviating these concerns?
Of course, if you study such sensitive topics on violence, you have to think about ethics on and how to protect your informants to a certain extent, to what is possible. But as I said, it was not that I was the only one talking about these topics. It was me, the trial, other therapists. It was kind of like we were all talking about these topics. So in that sense, I didn't feel that I was generating certain re-traumatizing situations because I was talking about this past. It was quite common in a sense to talk about it. And I also learned that re-traumatization is not per se something it's kind of strange now, but it's terrible. At the same time, it's also a very important and significant experiences that should be reflected upon again. So it was kind of, I became part of this ongoing reflection that we share. What did concern me was more engaging with perpetrators and being faithful to their story without justifying the violence. I think that still was and still is one of my ethical dilemmas. How can I write about them and show to the world how they understand the past and the present and how what justice is to them without justifying these horrific crimes. I think that was kind of complicated. And other forms of ethical dilemmas, no, I didn't really have. It was really how am I going to write about this without becoming morally blind or kind of turning these crimes into something, well, it happens or it's collateral damage, how many of these perpetrators talk about it. All the people were adults and they gave consent to participate, and the court hearings were public. And also I did inform the tribunals, okay, I'm from the Netherlands and I'm here to study the trials. Oh, yeah, great. I wasn't really the only one. Two other anthropologists that are colleagues of mine were also studying the trials. So, it was quite in that sense, it was, perhaps from a distance, it seemed more difficult than it eventually was to do the research, I guess.
Thinking a little bit about the big picture, what did you learn from your research about understanding historical violence and seeking to resolve it in the present?
Well, what did I learn? I think for now 10 years working on it and thinking about it. For me, what I really, really start to understand is that defiance was much more of a desire or an objective than something that can be fully accomplished and it can have an end or something. It really is not how justice is coming about. And this parts of injustices and unanswered sufferings that will always remain, I think that was something really important to come to realize, I guess. And this is something I also write in my conclusions, that the trials, like any other truth or justice practice, it kind of implicitly would involve this movement away from violence and suffering. And I think that's a very wrong conception, at least for Argentina. I came to understand these practices, the trials, and all these other truth to justice and memory practices rather as a way to keep the suffering and the violence in the ongoing present, to be around the victims and the suffering and the disappeared every day. And that's why I didn't like transitional justice from the beginning, but I also came to understand on a more profound level that it's very unsuitable to the context of Argentina. And as I already said, in Argentina themselves, they don't really like transitional justice as a term either to make sense of their reality. And it also, as I started to doubt, what is transitional justice? Where does it come from? And transitional comes in a sense from the Latin word transire, and that means also moving away from one state to the other. And I think it's these practices in Argentina, it's not, they don't aim at moving away from the violence. It's kind of rather the opposite, I would say. Yeah, I think that's the most important thing that I learned. And perhaps that a much more open idea of what justice is, this idea that it's something, it's kind of an open horizon. It's something that you always have to work for, but you will never, never accomplish it. It's kind of this oasis. I don't know. I think that's very important. Yeah.
And then that, you know, reminds me of a quote that you included in chapter 3 from Laura Figueroa, that is, quote, justice is not about the outcome. It is about the process. How was this applicable to your research, as well as the significance or insignificance of verdicts for the 5 military officers? Additionally, what might this tell us about the utility of, retributive justice proceedings as compared to more comprehensive approaches to justice in the aftermath of crimes against humanity and genocide?
No, I think it is very important. The process, as I said, is particularly for the victims being able to give testimony in front of the perpetrators, in front of the state, being heard. It's very important. And Laura, exactly, she quoted, she verbalized very well. No, it's about the process, and it's also keeping in mind acquittals were still a possibility. So even if the verdict was not the desired outcome, they would still have that process. And also, this process did not end after the verdict. More trials would come. Other truth and justice practices will continue. So yes, I think this focus on process, it fits very well my idea of phenomenal justice. And of course, and this is also, I think, what anthropologists should do. Our approaches and theorizing should derive from the people that we try to understand. And yes, Laura and all the others have been very influential in that sense to make sense of what was going on there. And I think another colleague of mine, Noah Weissman, she also, I really like how she phrases it. She goes, it's always justice to come, something to come. So what then to make of the trial? What's its utility? Yeah, I think we still have kind of like make it bigger than perhaps what it is, but it's not less important though. I think if the trials would not have been made possible in Argentina, I do think they would have continued struggling for it. So it also shows how important this legal trial is, this retribution. But it's not total. It's a part of this enormous field of practices and processes that deal with the past. And again, that's something ongoing that is not ended with one or two verdicts.
Well, we're coming near to the end here, but you know, this is the New Books in Genocide Studies network, and your book was published in the Rutgers Genocide, Political Violence, and Human Rights series. I'm curious, did you find, I mean, I've seen in my own, you know, look at genocide studies literature, there's been some increase in framing, you know, the crimes committed in Argentina as genocide. Did you find this term used by Argentinians in your research? And how far do you think the term applies?
It is in the Argentinian context, well, I would say a bit controversial, although the violence was targeted at one specific group, but that was based on ideological and political convictions, and therefore membership was very undetermined. And you also saw that in how randomly people were being kidnapped and tortured and killed. That were not only armed left-wing guerrillas, but genocide is being used among relatives and victims and also certain scholars to underline the horror of the crimes and its systematic nature. There is this whole local adaptation of el genocida, the genocider, to kind of rename the perpetrators to really emphasize the cruelties of the crimes that they committed, and kind of like left it aside to say this is genocide or not. As an anthropologist, again, I employed genocide in my work when people themselves used it to make sense of their experiences or to make sense of people in like, it's a genocider. So, yeah, and I think other colleagues have written that genocide is now becoming more and more important in Argentina, kind of like to keep its urge in the present, because it's 40 years ago, and to keep it important, perhaps these terms can help. I don't know if that's how it works. I don't know. I also think Argentina is exposed to other countries and other state crimes and how it's being dealt and how it's being named. So I think it's also more the transnational dimension in how these terms and concepts and practices travel. But I don't use it. I speak of state violence and crimes against humanity because that's how it's being phrased on the courts in Argentina.
Thank you. Well, as we come to a close, and as your book comes to a close, you wrote, quote, "The question of the universality of experience has long bothered anthropologists. By blending social philosophy and ethnography, anthropology has widely contributed to the existential question of what it means to be human. I very much welcome the recent turn to phenomenology and the life world in anthropology." You go on to say, "I see various potentials for phenomenological anthropology in rethinking contemporary and future conflicts, injustices, and their aftermaths in their multiple and unexpected forms." Can you close us out by talking a bit about this potential?
Yeah. Well, I think phenomenological anthropology or existential anthropology is a subdiscipline that I think is very eminent in redirecting research in anthropology and broader the social sciences, because it provides very, good ground to be faithful to what's actually going on there, what we always call grounded theory, instead of like implanting these unconsciously or sometimes consciously prior schemes on this messiness of real life and then all the consequences that it has, that we often miss out on how people make unexpected connections between things. Which, for example, this whole idea of justice and trauma without an end, I think it's very important that particularly social scientists that work in these high-stake environments and violent environments sometimes kind of take a few analytical steps back, I think, and bracket about their own assumptions and taking for grantedness. And I think phenomenological anthropology is allows you to do so. And then, for example, to give an example, I learned from the military that violence always takes different forms in combat, and it's always different than previous wars. So they always told me we were not prepared for the guerrilla warfare in cities and the ambushes in the mountains. We had the doctrine of independence wars and open fields and infantry against infantry. And I think this idea of that their doctrine is always kind of like lacking behind, I think that works also for our concepts and theories. To analyze or explain violence, we're always intrinsically falling behind. And if we look at the world now, I think the theater of war is again different. It's very different than the 70s. For like three, four decades, we're sending mostly global south peacekeepers to implement or maintain peace instead of like performing war. You see also now whole countries or governments becoming under virtual attack. Drones are now bombing civilians, or also perhaps less violent at first sight, but all the economic sanctions and embargoes, I think it's also forms of kind of new forms of war and violence that we also need to adjust our gaze perhaps. And I think it's a key scientific task to keep questioning anew and anew and anew how people themselves live within these circumstances without framing it beforehand with concepts and theories that arise out of previous violent situations. So that's why I think is bracketing what I think is so central to phenomenological anthropology, our own assumptions and our own concepts is very important. And you see phenomenological anthropology as it has been critiqued for being too little aware of structural inequalities and the bigger picture. I think it's a challenge to, if you use such a lens on new violences, I think this is where you have to try to see how it connects to these long-standing structural inequalities and perhaps transnational power plays going on, and still looking at how people live within these new forms of violence. And this is also a little bit what I'm trying to do now in new research in Venezuela. I'm kind of like returning 20 years back. I've always been keeping an eye on what's going on there. Of course, still people that I know live there. And I sometimes wonder, is the humanitarian crisis, it's a disastrous economic political mismanagement, or are there other underlying practices and beliefs that are also causing this enormous exodus and enormous violent situation for so many million Venezuelans? And I think, again, a grounded theory going in without already ideas where I should focus upon is very worthwhile. And I did 2 field trips already last year into the borderlands and to Caracas, and this intertwinement of kind of local, I call it viveza, kind of local entrepreneurship and then forms of survival really triggered my interest. And I think this whole idea, when does something become illegal and when is something moral, immoral? I think it's an interesting field to study, and I hope to be able to continue on this in the future. But time will tell. Yeah.
Thank you, Eva, for a very interesting conversation. Is this new research on Venezuela for another book project?
Well, I definitely hope to write another book somewhere in the future. I find it very rewarding. It's not an easy one, but I do think that sometimes articles work for maybe you have a very clear idea, but I do think a book allows you to provide more synthesis between topics and give you room to really reflect and allow stories to grow and develop throughout the book. So yes, I definitely would. I have plans to write a book on Venezuela, but I'm at the very, very beginning returning. So I first need to do quite some field work, interviews, go back, and then hopefully in a few years publish again a beautiful book. But time will tell, but I really hope so. Yeah.
Right. Well, we will definitely have to do this again when your book does come out. Eva, thanks so much for joining me again. I really appreciate your time, and take care.
Yes, thank you so much for the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you.